AgriTalk is brought to you by Full Scale from Helena. Grow strong returns this season with breakthrough foliar nutrition from Full Scale at Reproduction.
It's mid-March. Spring is in the air, and I, for one, am ready to get the 2021 growing season underway. Markets are strong, but there are some roadblocks in front of us. Grain logistics, trade, health, and the pandemic still linger, and today we'll cover them all.
From south of the border, well, one of the borders, via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning we'll begin with Tom Bernhard of the North Dakota Grain Growers Association. Then we've got Alan Morgan of the National Rural Health Association. And finally, Melissa Como of the American Red Cross. And right after the news, field agronomist Missy Bauer. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson, and now, filling in for Chip. From Real Ag Radio, the Ag Alberta Clipper himself, Sean Haney.
Welcome to AgriTalk, everybody. As Davis mentioned, I'm guest hosting today, Sean Haney of Real Agriculture and Real Ag Radio. It's great to be here. And Davis, boy, I'll tell you what, for some parts of North America, spring's kind of in the air. I'm looking forward to spring myself. It's been a long winter.
Spring was in the air for me. And then there was snow in the air. So I don't know what to make of it. Yeah. I really don't. Warmer days ahead.
It's mid-March. You know, I find March to be one of those months that is just so confusing because one day you almost get like those summer-like conditions, and then all of a sudden it's like boom, back to winter. So it's everybody's getting pretty itchy to get going.
Yeah, and I've gone all in on that concept. We did get 5 or 6-ish inches of snow here. I didn't scoop a single scoop shovel full of it. I'm counting on the sunshine to melt it off for me here. It's a gamble.
You mentioned Clipper, and I live in a spot where there is tons of Chinooks, man. And so this is the time, too, where it's like, yeah, it snows. You're like, yeah, I'm not going to. No, I'll just, the wind will take it. It'll be good. It'll warm up, and it'll be like, yeah, why exert myself? Why get too crazy about everything?
Nature knows what to do, you know? It'll take care of it.
But spring, baseball, we're only 2 weeks from opening day, you know, patios, I'm in the south end of Canada, but, you know, it is warming up. And so patios thinking about opening, those kinds of things, which is always something to look forward to as well, for sure.
So, absolutely.
As you mentioned, we got a great show today. Looking forward to getting to all these conversations. But of course, first, let's get to the news.
Sure thing, Sean. Well, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is working with other countries on an agreement to update corporate tax rules to establish a global minimum tax as the Biden administration considers raising taxes on businesses in order to finance other priorities. Yellen is participating in ongoing negotiations at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development about how to update global tax rules to reflect the digital economy. One pillar of the group's work is focused on a non-binding global minimum tax. Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, with some new ideas here as to better reflect the digital economy. This seems like just kind of a standard update that's probably long overdue, Sean.
We are going to hear more and more about taxes. We asked that question, how are we going to pay for all this stimulus? You know, I also saw something that she said something about increasing taxes for people over making over $400,000. I know in certain countries they're talking about a wealth tax if you have over a certain amount of assets. So this discussion is just starting.
Yep. Well, President Joe Biden chose an advocate for Native American farmers to be the top legal officer for the USDA as the administration seeks to redress a history of racial discrimination in farm loans and aid. Janie Sims Hipp, a member of the Chickasaw Nation and chief executive officer of the Native American Agriculture Fund, is the president's intended nominee to be USDA general counsel. That's according to a White House announcement yesterday. The position requires Senate confirmation. Hipp has worked with Vilsack during the Obama administration when he was also USDA secretary, as his senior advisor for tribal affairs, and later as director of the department's Office of Tribal Relations. And this is one of two key positions now with either held by Native Americans or with a Native American nominee. Interesting move here by the Biden administration.
Yeah, both President Biden and Secretary Vilsack have said that diversity is going to be important. And so they're, I guess, walking the talk, so to speak.
Well, the UK has declared China in breach of a 1984 Hong Kong declaration. Dominic Raab, Foreign Secretary of the UK, said radical changes planned by Beijing to restrict participation in Hong Kong elections represented a further clear breach of the legally binding declaration, this according to the Financial Times. His comments came ahead of the publication next week of a UK foreign and defense policy, which will see Boris Johnson's government set out its strategy for dealing with China. And Sean, we've got U.S. officials meeting with Chinese officials in Alaska on Thursday, and then a key report coming out on economic cooperation from the U.S. And now the U.K. is throwing in on China. It seems like things may heat up with China.
Yeah, you think we're definitely going to see this, and you know, and some of this is working together to put China in line. Some of it is countries being a lot more brave to speak out against China because they know the U.S. is talking the same language.
Well, U.S. beef exports to Japan will likely trigger a safeguard tax hike for the first time since August 2017. That would push tariffs from 25.8%. to 38.5% for the next 30 days. That's according to Kyoto News. And the Supreme Court, April 27, will hear refiners' appeal of the 10th Circuit Court ruling that invalidated three small refinery waivers. And finally, in his first interview as the nation's top environmental official, Michael Reagan told the Washington Post he is focused on restoring morale at the EPA, combating climate change, and lifting up communities burdened by pollution. On Monday, Reagan said he would not rule out the return of experts who fled the agency. A Washington Post analysis showed that during the first 18 months of the Trump administration, nearly 1,600 workers left the EPA, while fewer than 400 were hired. Sounds like Reagan at the EPA is going to have an open arms policy to those who fled the Trump administration. Sean, over to you.
Thanks a lot, Davis. They got some HR work to do, apparently. Okay, that was Davis Michelson with the news. Let's bring in Missy Bauer of B&M Crop Consulting. Missy, how are you?
Great. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing fantastic. So we've got the Farm Journal Field Days Planting Edition ongoing. Tell us about the planter clinic session that you were hosting.
Yeah, so it really kind of shows a lot of the hands-on. You know, one of the things we've seen agronomically in the field today is still we're just not getting that uniformity of emergence that we want out there. And we always talk about having these picket fence stands and photocopied plants and ears, and I think we've done a good job on the picket fence side, which means plant-to-plant spacing with the technology on the planters today. But where there's still a gap out there is on the photocopy side, trying to get all these plants to germinate and emerge at the same time. And it really goes back to planter settings, fine-tuning, when to change parts, when things are wore out. And so we really get into a lot of the details of basically a mini planter clinic today.
Yeah, you really can hurt yourself if you sort of make the assumption where you're like, there's a little bit more time. I can get another season out of that part. The results show you're best to make those changes and make sure you're running that planter just at optimal kind of settings.
That's right. I mean, there's a lot we need to do, you know, right now, while it's in the shop before we even head to the field, and try to get everything set perfect, set right in the shop. And then when we get to the field, we still got to go through our infield settings, but at least we know we've got kind of that foundation there of things being set right.
Well, Missy, really appreciate you joining us here this morning on AgriTalk. All the best to you.
Thank you.
That is Missy Bauer of B&M Crop Consulting. That's Farm Journal Field Days Planting Edition. Hey, coming up next on AgriTalk, we're going to talk to Tom Bernhardt. He is president of North Dakota Grain Growers Association. We're talking grain logistics and trade. We'll be right back right after this.
It starts with a plan. That's why America's Conservation Ag Movement is inviting you to get your farm business ready for 2021 with a free Resource Stewardship Planning Guide. Get your free guide today at agweb.com/ACAM.
And welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm today's guest host, Sean Haney of Real Agriculture and Real Ag Radio. If you want to join in the discussion today, you can send us a tweet. Use the hashtag AgriTalk, that is hashtag AgriTalk, or you can call the phone number 855-4-TALK-AG, that's 855-482-5524. Okay, let's get to our next guest. We're going to talk grain logistics and trade and see what's going on in North Dakota. We're talking to Tom Bernhardt. He is president of North Dakota Grain Growers Association. Tom, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, Sean?
Hey, I'm doing fantastic. So let's start off with trade. Tom, I found it interesting that Secretary Vilsack, early in his time back at USDA, in a couple different speeches, has mentioned that they want to make sure they hold Canada accountable under the new USMCA when it comes to the changes to wheat grading. Is this something that you continue to be pushing for in terms of making sure these changes happen?
That has been put in the back burner for a little while since that was all came out a few years back. But yes, at the same time, that is something that we're working on. You know, if you remember, they would only allow one North Dakota variety as their number one wheat or something that they would regard as a milling wheat. Mm-hmm. And that was the variety Glen, which is a North Dakota release. Well, other than that, if anything else shipped into Canada was not of that variety, it was, you know, designated as feed wheat, which we thought was very, very unfair, because when the tables turn, when the Canadians bring theirs down, of course it's not a level playing field.
Yeah, the changes are for wheat varieties grown in the U.S., but they still have to be registered varieties in Canada. Do you feel this grading change should have been under the new USMCA for all varieties grown in the U.S., whether they are registered in Canada or not?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Are you seeing, go ahead, Tom.
I just think that, you know, North Dakota, especially the North Dakota NDSU releases, some of those varieties are superior in baking quality and all other functionalities. They're superior to a lot of other varieties. So we need to have those folks recognize that and not pay the producer a feed price when that's brought over the border.
Yeah. Do you feel that this change is going to lead to more wheat exports from North Dakota into Canada? Because up until this point this year, I believe we've seen very, very little move north. Do you think that this change will change that?
I wouldn't be able to answer, but I would suspect if we'd ever get those differences ironed out, and the North Dakota producer could realize a better, you know, price, obviously, going into Canada, I'm sure they would. But until that is remedied, I don't see that happening.
Let's talk about rail transport. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, grain by train in both the U.S. and in countries like Canada. And
yes,
when I saw the cancellation of the Keystone Pipeline by the Biden administration early on in the administration, I right away thought about capacity at rail. And you know, if we are going to ship more oil and energy by rail, what does that mean for grain? Is this something that your organization is concerned about?
Yes. You know, we have some good news. We meeting North Dakota Grain Growers, we met with the BNSF officials last week. With it was called the National Ag Rail Business Council. We met with those folks last week, and we got a very positive report from those people. And you know, we expect no major negative impacts to grain and rail shipments due to the Keystone Pipeline shutdown. They indicated to us that they ship very little oil out of the Keystone area. So BNSF feels oil rail shipments will remain stable. There won't be much of an increase. And BNSF also feels that its billions of dollars in capital investments, especially along the northern route, will mitigate or negate any impacts from oil shipments. And, you know, one thing I want to emphasize is the BNSF folks emphasize it's not the same rail system as in 2013. So BNSF also feels it has the rail car engine and crew capacity to handle the Northern Tier group in 2021. And if I could give some highlights, you know, they indicated to us that in 2020, there was a 4.7% increase in volumes for agriculture products. Well, in some of the other products like consumer or coal or industrial products, those were all on negative, where they're spending a lot of time and effort to make sure our products are moved. And for instance, BNSF indicates a huge growth since like the year two. If we go back to the year 2000, they had 69 origins in 2000 compared to 254 origins in 2021. Only 32 destinations in 2000 compared to 110 in 2021. And also in Mexico, they had 32 Mexico shuttle destinations back in 2000. Today they have 38.
Wow.
Destinations. So they meaning BNSF, their performance shows a 15% increase in overall velocity increase, which, you know, obviously is I assume that must mean speed, and a 5% dwell improvement. Also 11% increase in agricultural miles per day. And lastly, they have a 2.63 shuttle turns per month. And so they're telling us that with their capital investments of $2.99 billion in 2021, they feel confident that they're going to be able to keep the egg producer products moving along quite nicely. So
yeah, well, that's good to hear. That's good to hear, Tom.
It was a positive meeting. Yes,
for sure. Well, and you know, there's listeners all over the United States here, and so they may not be familiar totally with what happens from getting product from the Dakotas out through the PNW. Having a good relationship with a railway like the BN is absolutely critical, because there's really that's the main carrier, correct?
Yes, it is. Absolutely, yeah. If you look at a map, if you can look at a map and see where the products are, where they originate from, and where they end up, it's quite impressive. And yeah, they're doing a nice job. It used to be problematic, but they're stepping up to the plate and doing the American farmer quite good.
Yep. Hey, Tom, we got about 45 seconds left here. Big changes to the crop mix at all in North Dakota? We've seen canola prices just absolutely skyrocket. Are we going to see more canola acres in the Dakotas?
I would say wheat acres are going to suffer unless we get an appreciable price coming up here in the next few weeks, because it's getting close to starting. But yes, I suspect lots of oil crops will be planted, whether it's sunflower. Obviously soybeans are going to be up, canola is going to be up. Some folks across the North Dakota area here, some of those folks don't necessarily like to grow canola. They're not geared for it. They don't have the equipment. But the people that traditionally grow canola, I would suspect their acres are going to be up substantially. But as a statewide, soybeans are going to be up. And I think sunflowers will be up as well.
Hey, Tom, really appreciate you you joining us here today on the show very, very much.
Well, thank you very much for asking. And if you guys ever need anything more from North Dakota grain growers, please reach out.
Yep. For sure. That is Tom Bernhardt with North Dakota Grain Growers. We'll be right back on AgriTalk right after this.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
I've got Jumpin' Jeff Wilson standing by from Pro Farmer. Jeff, it looks like so far in the day, the corn market gets the upside mover award, up a half cent in the May, up three quarters in July, and that's about the best we can say for the upside right now.
Yeah, kind of a disappointing trade in the corn market this morning. Corn was rallying into the break this morning. After the break, USDA reported China bought 1.156 million metric tons of U.S. corn, and the market made a new session high, but then reversed almost instantaneously after that reopening. We made a new session low. We've kind of stabilized here, but a little bit disappointing. It looks like it was kind of buy the rumor yesterday, sell the fact today. We do have the big meetings between U.S. and Chinese top officials at the end of the week in Alaska, so maybe there's just a little temperate there. And the other thing that's going on is the weather leans a little more negative. We're getting some rains across the Midwest in the hard red winter wheat belt, Argentina, and so that's kind of keeping a little bit of pressure on the grain markets, corn and wheat.
Yeah, a little. I guess the message there is a little less concern for the wheat crop as we're seeing some emergence
exactly.
Now.
Yeah. Plus, yeah. You also have some indications that the Russians may eventually get rid of their export tax if they have a good crop this year. So that kind of was the big negative in the wheat market overnight, including the improved crop ratings in some of the Plains winter wheat producing states. The soybean market is just kind of sloppy here. The harvest is picking up in Brazil, so we're getting a little harvest pressure there. And the meal failed to build up on any of the strength that it had yesterday. So meal's the key now to the beans, as well as how the harvest goes in Brazil.
All right. And livestock's just a little bit lower. Nearby live cattle, April down 42.5, June down 75. That's Jeff Wilson on Markets Now.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Bayer. For a strong start, trust the tried and true protection of Corvus and harness extra herbicides from Bayer.
And welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your guest host today, Sean Haney of Real Agriculture and Real Ag Radio. If you want to call in, it's 855-4-TALK-AG. That's 855-482-5524. Let's move over to more of a discussion about rural health. We're joined right now by Alan Morgan. He is CEO of the National Rural Health Association. Alan, how are you doing?
Sean, I'm doing well. Thank you for letting me join you today.
Absolutely. Great to have you. So, Alan, let's talk about, obviously, we got to talk about the pandemic when we're talking about health. How has the COVID-19 pandemic impacted rural communities, maybe differently than some of their some of the urban centers?
Yeah, it has been completely different. I got to be honest with you. Really not a lot of commonality, actually, between these small towns across the U.S. and urban areas. And let me start with some good news. This is the first time now, right now, over the last 2 weeks, since last summer, back in July, where we're actually seeing the COVID cases, the hospitalizations, and mortality at a lower rate in small towns all across the U.S. than their urban counterparts. And I say that because it is great news, but literally since summer, the pandemic has hit these small towns much more severely than their urban counterparts. And just to give you an idea, in December, according to the CDC, mortality rates per population in rural America was 48% higher than urban areas. And I just don't think that message has unfortunately gotten out there.
Do you say 44%?
48%. I know, 48. It's hard to believe.
Wow.
That the mortality was so much higher per population until you start thinking about who are our family and friends that live in rural America. You know, it's an elderly population, a higher percentage of elderly living in these small towns. And per population, you've got people with multiple comorbidities, you know, high incidence of obesity, diabetes, hypertension. Really, you've got in rural America the population that was most at risk for COVID. And for most of this pandemic, let's be honest, in small towns across the U.S., we've been kind of hesitant to wear a mask and to social distance. And those two things coming together really hit us hard.
Well, one of the goal lines has been the vaccine. And, there's the rollout is underway. Some of the audience has been able to get one or two of their shots or is hoping too soon. How has the vaccine rollout gone in rural communities?
Yeah, well, we hit the high point already, unfortunately. Now we start talking about the problems. And it's been a mixed bag across the U.S. because we've got 50 different states with 50 different plans. And in a rural context, it's for us, we have fewer providers there that can actually administer the vaccine, number one. So that creates a problem. Number two, we just had some problems in distribution out, getting it out to the clinics and to the hospitals. And then three, unfortunately, at least the beginning of this, we're seeing higher rates of vaccine hesitancy among rural towns. So there are communities out there that have done a fabulous job. I've heard of great examples in states like Nebraska and Kansas, and West Virginia certainly are good examples. But again, I can't stress this enough. I just got off the call with the CDC this morning about it. There are 50 different states doing 50 different things, and the rural rollout has been mixed at best.
So logistically speaking, why is there struggles to get the vaccine out into some of these communities? Like, we figured out, a typical response here would be, we can put a man on the moon. How come we can't get vaccines into rural communities? What's going on here?
Yeah, this could be a much longer segment than we have to cover. Let me give you a couple examples. Small town in North Carolina with a rural health clinic, they were offered 100 doses of the vaccine, and they simply said, we don't have the staffing to get 100 doses in the arm before the vaccine is no longer good in our context. So number one, that's a problem. Number two, there's tremendous pressure on the states to get as many shots in the arm as quickly as possible. And so you see them going to these max vaccination locations in state capitals. It's an easier way to do it, to get the numbers up, but then that makes it a problem for rural, if you've got a rural farmer or rancher, to take the day off to drive, an hour to get vaccinated and come back, it's not really an option. So you've got just the logistics of getting this vaccine out and then the practicality of getting it administered in a rural context.
Rural hospitals, what impact is COVID-19 having on sort of the occupancy of rural hospitals? Because there was a lot of speculation that, some of these hospitals just wouldn't be able to handle the volume of people coming into the hospital because of COVID-19. What's the status of that?
Yeah, now we're getting from, we're steadily taking this conversation downhill quickly. Huge problem that we've seen over the last year is a lot of these communities, they're worried about COVID. They're not going to their local hospital to get the routine care done, even though you're seeing in the hospitals are usually the safest place in the entire town because you've got the mask wearing, you've got the social distancing. And so we've seen decreased volumes until they get these surges. And when they get the surges, they're paying extra for their healthcare staff to work overtime. You've got a lot more cost associated with that. That's a long way of saying that we had more rural hospitals closed last year than at any time in the last 25 years, which is hard to believe. 20 rural communities lost their hospital, which in most cases is that town's largest employer. And in the middle of a pandemic, we shut down rural hospitals. I can't even believe I'm saying that.
A lot of discussion right now about the impact of the lockdowns. Now, a lot of times there's the discussion around mental health impacts, but there's also the physical health impacts of some of these lockdowns, gyms not being open. What do you think that impact is? And is it as negative as some people are saying?
Oh, yeah. I don't think you can understate that. And it's disappointing when you hear an either or discussion on this. It's both. The impact of COVID on hospitalizations and mortality has been horrific, let's be honest. But the impact on mental health has just been severe. The good news is that the federal government did allow the opening up of telebehavioral health. And so the ability for people to seek necessary behavioral health, mental health from their own home and not having to go into a location, that's great. But we just can't underestimate, especially among our ranchers and farmers out there, the impact that this has had, because just the overall stress on the family and as you mentioned, in many cases, the hesitancy to get into town has just created a real problem going ahead. And I'm really optimistic that we're going to see both the state level and at the federal level try to address this by increasing access to behavioral health specialists in a rural context and really pivoting to focus more on this as we come out of this crisis.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, Alan. You know, there's been so much focus on making sure the elderly are safe, but there hasn't been a lot of focus on, if you want to take it all the way to the other end of the age pendulum, focus on kids' well-being. You know, not related to directly having health issues with the yeah. with the virus, but more from like, you know, not being able to play baseball or football or things like that, because that takes its toll long term as well.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Its impact has been on not just, as you mentioned, the elderly, but the family in general and communities as well, too. This is going to have to refocus us on how are we delivering healthcare in small towns to begin with. I mean, I really think you're going to see much more of a nationwide push on doctors and nurses of keeping rural communities healthy and out of the emergency room as opposed to just treating them when they're ill. And this is a huge shift that we're going to have to see, and we're starting to see already from a rural healthcare standpoint.
Well, and lots of talk, you know, you turn on the news at night and you're like, you know, people talking about telehealth and the growth of that, but there's challenges with, you know, that sounds great for rural communities because then they wouldn't have to go into the doctor, as you mentioned, but you got to have rural broadband to make that happen, right? So yeah. there's still some roadblocks to get through.
Yeah. Before this pandemic, when you talk about telehealth pre-pandemic, you're really talking about going into your clinic or your hospital and having a specialist from an urban area beam in and talk to you there. This pandemic has opened up telehealth into your own home. So this is what I was promised, you know, when I was watching the Jetsons grow up, that you'd have the doctor there in your home room. But you're absolutely right. It takes access to high-speed broadband. And sometimes when I'm out, especially in eastern Nebraska and western Kansas, those areas, you're talking adequate cell phone service. And a lot of these telehealth provisions that we're going to be utilizing are going to be over your cell phone. So you got to make sure that your parents have a smartphone that allows video, number one, and you've got to have good cell phone service. So we have to have that broadband and access to just basic cell phone service has to go hand in hand as we move forward.
Absolutely. There's a lot of reasons to push for an increase to the capacity of rural broadband, not just in the U.S., but other countries as well. Rural people around the world really, really suffering from inadequacies when it comes to broadband, as that becomes just so much more critical in every day of our life. Alan, I really appreciate you joining us here today on AgriTalk. Important discussion, and thank you so much.
Oh, happy to be here as always. Thanks.
That is Alan Morgan. He is CEO of the National Rural Health Association. Just critical stuff there. And when you talk about some of the differences in between how COVID-19 has impacted rural communities versus urban centers getting a lot of the attention, even when it comes to, you know, making the numbers on the vaccine rollout, rural communities need to be accounted for as well. We'll be right back on AgriTalk right after this.
I'm Andrew McRae, inviting you to join me for Farming the Countryside, a farmer-focused podcast important to agriculture, and is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Visit pivotbio.com to find a representative near you.
Your next piece of equipment is on MachineryPete.com. Search equipment from dealerships across the country to find what you're looking for, only on MachineryPete.com.
Getting fired up here in the morning on AgriTalk. I'm today's guest host, Sean Haney of Real Agriculture and Real Ag Radio. Our next guest is Melissa Como. She is director of the American Red Cross Military and Veteran Caregiver Network. Melissa, how are you doing?
Good. It's so good to be with you today.
Yeah, it's great to chat with you. Heavy, important topic. We just talked about the impacts of COVID-19 on rural communities. Now we're going to focus and shift some of that to the military. How has COVID-19 impacted the military and veteran communities, maybe differently than the general public?
Great question. And thank you so much for paying special attention to this community. So can you imagine being deployed right now? I mean, we have a global pandemic going on right now. Your loved one's deployed. Maybe you're worried about your family, dealing with the pandemic back home. Well, the stress of that has been really hard on military families. Our veteran families are facing sort of changes in their health care, less access to services, and that social isolation that's, just plaguing all of us right now. So what we've done at the Red Cross is we've tried to create programs and services to reduce that social isolation. Our Hero Care Network is still providing emergency communications for those loved ones overseas. We have financial aid available to those who are being impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. And we just keep building on this, hoping that veterans, families, caregivers, and our military know they can come to the Red Cross for support.
Yeah, it's. I hear you on that isolation part, and some of the stresses of taking care of yourself and your own family while you have a spouse potentially that is very, very far away overseas. You can definitely imagine that kind of stress. So, from an American Red Cross's perspective, do you backfill some of the work here that the VA doesn't do, or like what is the role the Red Cross plays in this issue?
So the Red Cross doesn't backfill anything at the VA, but we have amazing volunteers that are reducing provider burnout by providing extra support for, say, telehealth appointments. Providing that clinical volunteering is so critical. We also have volunteers in VA hospitals providing comfort kits and supporting veterans that might be isolated from not, just being in the hospital, but for the whole COVID situation as well. We also have our very popular visiting dogs, which are all, social distance and COVID safe. But these animals are really brightening spirits at VA hospitals.
Tell me more about the dog program. That sounds like it's pretty popular. How does it work?
So we have what we call our Service to the Armed Forces visitation dogs, and they are specially trained dogs to kind of, how happy a dog makes everyone. They really stand out in these sort of clinical, very sterile environments as, a friendly face, maybe wagging the tail, where veterans and their caregivers can interact with the animal and just have a little bit of joy as they're going in for maybe a medical appointment or if they're in an extended hospital stay. Dogs make everything better.
So there's two sides to this. One is, people assisting, trying to help out, answering the question of how do you help, but we'll get to that in a second. If there's somebody listening to the program that, is a part of a military family and they are kind of going through some of these struggles, do they just contact the American Red Cross directly or how do they do that?
Absolutely. So you can download the Hero Care app for free from, wherever you get your Apple or Android apps. That's going to give you sort of a first step of all the things that Service to the Armed Forces at the Red Cross can help you with. We also have our Hero Care Resource Directory, and this resource directory has at least 800 resources for every zip code in America. So you're never going to go to that and find nothing. Even in our rural communities, there are at least 800 resources that you can categorize based on being a veteran. Maybe you're in the National Guard or in a reserve unit and aren't as connected as you'd like to be. Maybe you're a caregiver caring for someone with a traumatic brain injury. All of those types of filters are available so people can really dive in and get the support they're specifically looking for.
These families, they go through a lot, right? They, as we talked about, someone in the family goes overseas, puts their life in danger, and then to go through all that during a pandemic where, potentially there's health risks at home too, it also puts stress on the person that's overseas, right? It's not just not the person that is here at home. There's a lot of issues that can develop out of something like a pandemic that we've been experiencing.
Yes, we've seen extended deployments where the travel has been hiccuped basically due to the COVID-19 restrictions with travel. So that service member might be expecting to be home on a certain date, and all of a sudden it's months later. And the Red Cross has been there to help these families. You know, we are doing comfort kits for families that are separated, but also supporting that service member with communication, emergency communication, just to sort of help do what we can in this very challenging space.
So if somebody wants to help out financially, you know, how do they get involved and how do they help?
Well, it's a great month to ask about this because March is actually Red Cross Month. And those looking to support the Red Cross can go to redcross.org/volunteer, and you'll see a lot of opportunities for you to serve military and veteran families as a volunteer opportunity. I'm a little bit biased being a proud Marine Corps spouse and caregiver, so I love the service to the Armed Forces mission. It's very close to my heart. But you can connect there with other people who are looking to support our heroes, and I'm just so grateful for anyone that steps up and helps the American Red Cross.
And if somebody was going to volunteer, is it a lot of time?
No, we have been rated one of the best organizations to volunteer with. At my network with the Military and Veteran Caregiver Network, we can work with caregivers who are already spread so thin and find them opportunities to volunteer that make sense and work with their time constraints.
Great stuff. Melissa, I really appreciate you joining us here today on AgriTalk.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. That is Melissa Como. She's director of the American Red Cross Military and Veteran Caregiver Network. Download that app, get involved, look to volunteer. Great stuff. Very, very important stuff. Support those military families. Hey, thanks for listening this morning. This has been a lot of fun. Guest hosting, really do appreciate it. Come back this afternoon. Joel Vaklovic will sit in for Chip, and his guest will be Dwayne Bussey from Bolt Marketing. And tomorrow morning, Margie Eckelkamp will be here, and she will be your host. Thanks, everybody, for listening to AgriTalk. I'm the guest host, Sean Haney of Real Agriculture. Have a great day. Cheers, everybody.